Nobody gets hacked. To get hacked, you need somebody with 197 IQ, and he needs about 15% of your password, right?
That was U.S. President Donald Trump there with some alternative facts on security. Thanks, guy. This is the Risky Business Podcast, and my name is Patrick Gray. We'll be checking in with Adam Boileau in just a moment and talking through all the week's security news. And then we'll be hearing from our friends at CMD Security in this week's sponsor slot. CMD CEO Jake King and CTO Mike Sample join the show this week to talk through a new remote access tech release from HashiCorp called Boundary and what that means for Linux system observability in your environment. So we'll get into that in a little while. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, the United States has indicted the so-called Sandworm crew. They've unsealed a bunch of indictments, complete with what looks to be at least one webcam picture, which is always a very satisfying thing to see in the indictments.
Yeah, I mean, we've been wondering for a while, you know, when some things are going to come home to roost for the Sandworm crew after, I mean, I suppose not Petya, but also, you know, this indictment has, you know, made some of the accusations around that particular crew going after the Olympics in Korea a couple of years ago now, you know, that's now attributed officially rather than just kind of, you know, on the quiet or on the side as we had seen previously. But yeah, seeing some actual indictments on the back of, you know, some of the stuff that they've been doing, and, you know, this is the crew that, you know, took out the power in Ukraine, responsible for NotPetya, the Olympics, and apparently also some other stories are suggesting that they were investigating or attacking towards the now postponed Tokyo Olympics, which, you know, makes a lot of sense. Went after the, you know, people who were looking into the nerve agent used to poison the Skripals in London. You know, crew that's been doing a lot of bad stuff, and I think at this point the US have decided to tip their hand. And yeah, the indictment does make it look like, you know, it's pretty clear that the infrastructure over at Sandworm HQ has been pretty thoroughly, owned by somebody.
Well, I think it was Thomas Reed on Twitter who was like, well, if this is the stuff they're willing to give up,
yeah,
you know, imagine what US access into this crew looks like at the moment. I mean, it's wild. But I mean, you know, you just look at the indictment, the scope of it, these guys have been busy.
Yeah, and it's quite a small crew, I guess, for how much they're up to. And obviously there must be other people involved. Mm. You know, they wouldn't have named everybody. But they're a really busy outfit and, you know, a lot of pretty good hacking going on. But I think, you know, this is, you know, certainly, you know, we've seen a lot of signaling going on about norms and whatever. And this is a crew that really hasn't had much respect for, you know, what few norms there are. I mean, NotPetya, a great example of a thing that really went wildly out of control, power as well.
Like they had evidence in the indictment of them like celebrating and stuff when NotPetya happened. Like, you know, job well done. I mean, that tells you the sort of organization you're talking about here. Just absolute chaos agents.
Yeah, well, exactly. And that's, you know, that's kind of Russian doctrine, you know, would confuse us about what's going on. We saw the misattribution of the attacks against the Olympics, you know, where they had purposely tried to frame the North Koreans or the Chinese, neither of which went particularly well.
Yeah, but I mean, that lasted about 10 seconds, Adam. I mean, everyone talks about, it's a false flag. It's like that everybody saw through pretty much immediately. You know, that was terribly done.
Yes, perhaps not their finest work, but yeah, no, it's just, you know, sending a message, and, you know, obviously these are people who are not going to see the inside of a US courtroom in the near future, but it does, you know, limit their holiday options. And I mean, whether this, you know, kind of signaling really does anything for the people operating in this field, I mean, you know, we've seen a bunch of the other crews in Russia get rolled. I mean, was the Dutch was up in one of the other bears, you know, taking pictures out of the webcams and stuff. I don't know if that's really changed their cadence and operational tempo and stuff, but it's still kind of embarrassing, and it still obviously complicates their lives personally. But, you know, I guess if you're being compelled to do this work by Mother Russia anyway, then maybe you don't have a whole bunch of choice.
Yeah, I think, though, you're right. Like, the Russians do have a habit of getting pantsed publicly quite a lot, which considering how much badness they inflict on people, like, it's not like we're feeling sorry for them or anything. But, I mean, they do get owned quite a lot, you know.
They do have a rough time, but I mean, it's hard securing your stuff, you know,
it's all in the game. It's all in the game. I have looked high, Adam. I have looked low, and I cannot find any consensus on whether or not the Cyber Command of Microsoft actions against TrickPot have actually done anything. Apparently, Microsoft is saying, like, you know, 94% of their C2 is offline, and, you know, they're trying to bring it back up, and we keep knocking it down, us and our partners. Other people are saying, well, we're just seeing them roll out different configs, and, you know, they're still springing up new C2. I think it's going to be a little while before we really know how effective these legal and other actions have been against it.
I mean, I'm sure it's making their lives a bit more difficult operating their botnet, but I mean, there's just so much kind of malleability in all of these networks. And, you know, it's even, you know, can be as simple as, you know, go hire access to a different botnet and use that to redeploy your new botnet and kind of get on with life. Or, you know, maybe it is genuinely making things difficult. But yeah, you're right. It's going to take a while, you know, to see how it shakes out, you know, whether they kind of give up and go home, whether they build something different. You know, it doesn't seem likely that it's going to stop. Running cyber crime operations. I'm sure there's plenty of money, you know, in the bank from, you know, the work that they've done so far. But yeah, I mean, you know, Microsoft's work certainly, you know, been useful in the past, and I don't think this is any different. But, you know, is it effective long term? Probably not.
Well, let's see, right? And one thing I forgot to mention last week too is we did mention that TrickBot has fallback C2 using Emma DNS and Tor. So that means, you know, if you're running an enterprise network, blocking outbound to Tor or Emma DNS is probably a good idea.
Well, yeah, there's not a whole bunch of reason for enterprise networks to be chatting to the Tor network, so it's probably a good idea anyway, you know, solve a bunch of other problems while you're at it, you know, apart from privacy. But hey, it seems worth it.
Now, we've got a story here from ZDNet where Catalin Kimpanu has written up NSA's list. NSA has published a list of the top vulnerabilities currently targeted by Chinese hackers. This is the sort of snapshot that I think is really actually important. It's an important news item this week, and I haven't seen too many people cover it because I think there's a tendency for a lot of the security media to just go, oh, that's the tech stuff. That doesn't matter. But this is very interesting, right? Because you look at the vulnerabilities on this list, and they're completely different to the ones that you would have seen on a similar list 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's very tempting to go, hey, just the listicle, write it off, don't really, you know, think about it. But you're right, it is a really interesting list, and it is very different than what we have seen, you know, a few years ago. You know, the kind of the phase where we went through everything being web app bugs has kind of faded away, and the phase where it was all browser bugs has faded away. And this list is really interesting. You know, the top ones are exactly what you'd expect, Pulse Secure, the F5 bugs, Citrix bugs.
Do you remember the first episode this year was we started off by saying, hey, you know, we spotted this Citrix bug that got dropped in December. We, you know, this could actually be a big deal. And that was before it had been pocked and got out there. But it's just amazing how that's, you know, because that's been over this year that this big pivot has happened.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's testament to a bunch of the really good work on the browser, you know, the browser environment and other areas of the ecosystem. But you know, I don't think it's going to stop going this way as well. Like we've seen, you know, a heap of bugs in security products, you know, this week even, which we'll talk about in a second. But yeah, this list is just, you're right, it's different and interesting. There's a bunch of internal stuff that we're seeing used for privilege escalation, lateral movement, you know, the Netlog on bug, for example, that Windows DNS bug from a while ago, you know, a few weeks ago. There's been some really good stuff, and it's interesting how, looking at this list, how new some of these bugs are. I mean, Netlog on was only, you know, like a week or two ago, and it's already kind of, you know, in this list as a thing that people are using in the wild, which shows kind of the speed of things moving. So yeah, it is actually interesting, right? It's not just you know, blah, blah, boring, a bunch of CVEs, who cares?
Yeah, now you just mentioned something interesting there where you said, oh, it's interesting to see how new these bugs are, right? And most of them are 2020, 2019, right? There's a few 2018s, a couple of 2017s. But I don't know if you spotted the bug at number 15, Adam.
Number 15, CVE 2015, Oracle WebLogic bugs, arbitrary deserialization. Yeah.
Now, what does that tell you? What does that tell you when a bug in Oracle that was fixed in 2015 is the 15th most exploited bug by Chinese foreign intelligence agencies in the year 2020? What does that tell you? It tells you what we already know, which is no one patches their Oracle stuff because it's too brittle.
Yes, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Oracle, when you see Oracle stuff kicking around the network, usually it's not internet facing, which is its saving grace. But when you do see it, you know that you're on a, you know, one-way train to Shelltown because no one patches it. It's really difficult to patch. Whenever they do patch the bug, the next you know, servlet over, or the next, you know, parameter over, will be the same bug that they didn't patch. So even if you just look at the Oracle patches and then increment by one, you'll find the next exploit. I mean, that can be as little as an hour. You know, I did it in the lobby of a conference, you know, when Silvio needed a bug, and so I went and looked at the previous bug I had. I incremented by one, I found the next bug, weaponized it, job done. Oracle products, yay. So yeah, it's so 100% normal for Oracle.
Now, as you previewed, we got a couple of stories here about some different bugs, man. And like, okay, so here's one. It's another one by Catalan. Apparently, there is a bug in SonicWall VPNs, which is at the moment a DOS condition that could be remotely exploitable. Now, if someone drops POC for this bug, right, reliable POC, there's 800,000 of these things out there, and it's going to be carnage.
Yes, I mean, if someone pocks this up, we have a working exploit for it, then, you know, of those 800,000 Sonic Walls, they will all get shelled in
all of them in
days, right?
Yes.
I mean, if that. Because that's, people understand the value of edge security control bugs like this, and all of the actors know how useful it is, you know, and yeah, they will move, because you've got to move to get there first and kick everybody else out. Yeah, they're going to get wrecked if the bug is, you know, genuinely exploitable, and it's, you know, we haven't seen one yet, but, you know, it does seem like it's probably going to be.
Yeah. I mean, the bug has a CVSS of 9.4 out of 10. Right. Yeah. So that's the thing. There's been some bad ones. And that is a border device. That is internet facing by design, right? So if you do have any SonicWall stuff, go patch it. And this one, also pretty serious. There's a VMware bug kicking around. Again, no POC, but 9.8 CVSS in ESXi? I mean, ooh.
Yeah, I mean, VMware bugs are always bad because people do rely on it for a security control in so many different, you know, kind of, there's so many different sets of attack servers in VMware. The one that's CVSS 9.8 is a attack in the management service is a user after free in the one of the services that the ESXi, you know, hypervisors expose. So you need to be on the network in a position to get there, which is not an unreasonable prerequisite. But the impact of shelling someone's ESX is obviously super bad. There's a few other really good VMware bugs in there. There's some, you know, out-of-bounds memory read and writes, which not great because those are from inside the VM going up towards the hypervisor. So, you know, that's a thing that, you know, a lot of people care about.
But this is funny, right? Because I can remember for the last, you know, 10 years, we've been talking so much. We spoke so much on this show about how enterprise software is just so bad. And those chickens are finally coming home to roost in 2020.
Yeah, and it's certainly the case for all of the boundary control products, like the security edge gateways and privileged access management.
Wait till people really start having a crack at AV, though, because that's coming next. You know, that'll be 2021. Ooh, baby.
Well, I mean, you know, there's certainly plenty of history of people going after AV, and it always has been, you know, has been a bad time.
But not en masse, not like this. You know, this is different. This is like, you know, at scale stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, anything that, you know, passes conduit from a lower trust boundaries, you know, always going to be a good target, and there's a lot of complexity in there, a lot of old parsing, a lot of unsandboxed rubbish. I mean, it's got all of the things that people look for in attack surface.
2021, bring it, bring it. What else have we got here? We got Rudy Giuliani being Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah, for God's sake.
Yeah, this crazy story of, like, I mean, it's not even something we'd discuss if Twitter hadn't enacted its, you know, its policy, right? So, okay, take a step back. The New York Post published an article claiming that the son of the US presidential candidate Joe Biden, the son Hunter Biden, apparently dropped his laptop off for repair, dropped it off in Wilmington, where he does not live, to have his computer, to have his computer repaired, and the computer store guy, he left it there, apparently abandoned it, and computer store guy somehow gave it to Rudy Giuliani because reasons,
do, right?
As you do. And there are emails on there, you know, exposing shady dealings with, you know, Ukrainian companies and whatnot, and pictures of Hunter Biden taking drugs and videos of him hanging out with hookers and doing drugs and stuff. So New York Post wrote this story. And the story is just, I'm speaking as a journalist here, not even as an InfoSec person. The story just doesn't really look that well balanced and researched, shall we say. In fact, New York Times has a piece that says even the person whose byline was on that story didn't even know their byline was going to be on it because no one wanted their name on the story because it was that shoddy. But Twitter and Facebook actually blocked the story initially, saying that it was caught under their hacked materials policy. And that, of course, you know, Streisanded the hell out of it, and Twitter later backed down. But this is a really interesting and different sequence of events to what we would have seen in 2016, right? Like, because most of the other media didn't take the bait. Twitter and Facebook clamped down. Interesting thing there, though, and Brett noticed this, is they said that they'd seen signals that there was something wrong with this story, and they didn't say what those signals were. And I'm wondering if they saw botnets pushing it or something. But, I mean, God, how did I go recapping this lunacy, Adam?
I mean, that seemed like a pretty fair summary of it. And it's, you know, it is mostly interesting not because of the content, but because of the comparison to 2016, right? Just the different approach to how we look at handling the hacked or leaked or, you know, otherwise weirdly sourced content. And yeah, the reactions from Twitter and Facebook is just, you know, it's a... You know, we've thrown so much criticism, I guess, at the social media networks for inflaming a lot of this stuff. And now seeing what it looks like when they are trying to counter some of that, it's definitely an interesting, you know, interesting set of affairs.
I think they went too far by actually just blocking the story, right? Because you're just giving too much ammunition to people to claim it's censorship, you know, when it's been published in a major publication, even though it's a terrible publication, it is a major publication, right? So, you know, maybe labeling this stuff. And that's where they landed. They came back and said, okay, we shouldn't have done that. In future, we're just going to label this information. What do you think about that, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just blocking this stuff outright does have a bunch of kind of consequences, and labeling it, letting people make the decisions themselves, is a little bit more, you know, I guess, neutral, and it gives people the ability to kind of make their own choices, which is really, I guess, what we're asking, right, is to not have, you know, the social network just, you know, curating purely kind of clickbaity content that's going to make people, you know, go down that rabbit hole, giving them the options, giving them the information. That's probably, you know, where this should fall. So I think it's, you know, it's good that we're having the conversations though, right, and that there is a bit of back and forward and that they're willing to change, you know, rather than just do it, move on and forget about it and not think about what people's responses have been.
Yeah, I'm still really curious to know what they meant by we had signals on this one.
Interesting, yeah.
It is interesting, right? And Brett noticed that. He's got the details in yesterday's newsletter. Everyone, go subscribe to the newsletter because there's so much stuff in there that we just do not get to cover in the show. What else have we got here? Oh, yeah, and just sort of on a semi-related note, there's a bunch of emails targeting voters in Florida in the United States right now that purport to come from like info@theproudboys.com or whatever, and saying that, you know, info@officialproudboys.com, and basically saying if you don't vote for Trump, we know who you are and we're going to go beat the crap out of you, pretty much.
Which, I mean, that's a little bit more basic approach to, you know, election manipulation. I mean, I guess they're using a computer, so probably we would call it hacking these days somehow. But yeah, this is a little bit more common garden.
I don't think that's going to move votes in one direction or another. Like, it's just total chaos stuff, right? It's just trolling, it is. Basically.
And of course, the question is, is it Russians? Because, I mean, why not, right? I mean, it totally could be these days.
The FBI are apparently having a look into that, right? So that'll be interesting. what else have we got? Google coughed up some info on attacks against the Biden campaign. Interestingly, they were hosting all of their malware on legitimate services like Dropbox and GitHub. I'm presuming it was Shane Huntley at Google Tag wrote that up, and then CyberScoop has the story.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, you know, a trend that anyone who's been doing incident response and investigation has seen, like this move towards hosted trusted platforms as a way to move your stuff around and keep it, you know, inside, you know, network channels that are protected and sources that are regarded and trusted and that kind of thing. It's certainly helpful. I mean, this particular campaign, it's kind of hard to say whether it went anywhere. You know, it looked like the Google says it looked like the Chinese going against the DNC. But yeah, the overall kind of way that they approached it seemed pretty modern.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, you know, this sort of collection is to be expected. Everybody wants insight into policy platforms and stuff like that, you know. The weird thing is where they start giving it to the New York Post or, you know. But that's the thing, like, even in the newsletter, we were like, could this be a Russian op? Sure. You know, could the emails be faked or could they be genuine? I mean, anything is possible. Or it could just be Rudy Giuliani being Rudy Giuliani, you know. ASCII shrug. Scoop of the Week goes to Sean Lingas over at CyberScoop, who has managed to tie... So we spoke about this FBI and CISA alert from October 9 that talked about a hacking campaign targeting US government systems. Sean has managed to tie that to Russian state-backed activity. He's tied it specifically to Energetic Bear because he got his greasy mitts on some Mandiant documents.
Yeah, I think in this case, there was some like shared technical infrastructure that kind of linked this to operations by the Energetic Bear actor earlier on. Mandiant seems to have tied that together. There was also some suggestion that it was in, I think like some of these attacks were into state election-related infrastructure, which I don't think we had seen any real description of who the targets were when the CSER and FBI were talking about it a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, and I'd expect in coming days they're probably going to ask a lot of these state government and local government admins to maybe go have a look in their logs to find evidence of this activity. But it's a it was a fantastic scoop. So well done to Sean. Another one from him. He's written up the New York regulators' report into the breach at Twitter, and I find it really interesting that we've got a government report that takes Twitter to task for using software-based MFA on privileged accounts, right? And their whole thing is like, you've got to use hardware-based MFA.
Which, I mean, it's certainly better than no MFA, software-based MFA. I mean, that makes life more difficult for an attacker, but...
But it can be socially engineered, which is exactly what happened in this case.
Exactly, yeah. And I think, part of the argument is that the impact, the compromise of Twitter's, admin applications and Twitter in general is so large that maybe they should have spent the $20 a user to, get themselves a U2F token or something like that that makes that whole process of attacking MFA a bit more complicated. And honestly, I don't think that's an unreasonable position to take. I mean, when you're considering, global communication systems like Twitter, yeah, you probably should.
Yeah, well, they've hired a CISO. They didn't actually have one when all this happened, Rinky Seth, who is she's a former IBM executive, has joined Twitter as a CISO. So congratulations to her. But yeah, look, I think when you've got a social media company getting spanked for not using U2F keys, like, I think it's time that basically every enterprise considers using U2F keys for the more sensitive, privileged users, right?
Yeah, I mean, hardware tokens, regardless of what they are going to make it a little bit more difficult for attackers. And, obviously there's ways to go around the MFA, but yeah, just being social by a bunch of kids on Discord is kind of embarrassing, and that's not a thing that anyone wants to have to deal with. And, $20 a user or whatever, totally worth it.
Can you reliably get around a YubiKey?
Well, I mean, one doesn't go through these things. One goes around it, right? One has to find another way, through whatever it is, around the network or into the admin system or,
Or malware onto the endpoint that is being authenticated, right? Like, I get that. But, it gets you – I don't think it just gets you a little way, in the realistic threat environment, right? Like, I think it actually gets you quite a long way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely, right? It's absolutely the best option for MFA.
Because it sounded like you were talking them down a little there, Adam. It did sound like you were talking them down a little there, dude.
This just, in an enterprise environment where it's a big, if you're going up against a web app and you've got no other options than to just log in, then you're pretty screwed at that point by hardware MFA. If it's an enterprise environment, hey, there's always ways,
There's always ways, yeah. But this would have been some internally developed, internally facing admin panel that would have crushed it. Anyway, moving on. Oh, the German authorities have raided the offices of FinFisher, makers of the FinSpy software. This action pertains to FinFisher's sale of its spyware tools to the Turkish government without an export license. The crazy thing is, though, they've been doing this for a long time. There's been so much evidence that they have sold stuff without an export license in the past, and the government hasn't taken action until now, but I think it's just sort of got to the point where there's just so much evidence out there publicly that they just have to do it.
Yeah, I guess the situation with Turkey specifically, Turkey's been antagonizing the rest of Europe, so there's a little bit of perhaps extra motivation there. FinFisher have said, we sold it all through a subsidiary in Malaysia, so we didn't need export licenses. The German
which is news to regulators who've pointed out that because the software was developed in Germany, the regulations cover them.
Yes, well, I'm sure corporate legal counsel is going to give them a refund or something for that particular piece of advice. But yeah, I don't think the Germans are going to take that particularly seriously, and we'll see what happens to them.
Yeah, we will. Meanwhile, a lawsuit lodged by Jamal Khashoggi's fiance and the pro-democracy group that he founded. There's some interesting details in there that Shannon Vavra spotted and screen capped and put on Twitter. But basically, the lawsuit argues that NSO Group malware was placed onto one of Khashoggi's friends' phones, and the Saudis were able to collect intelligence on him through that.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly not a great position for NSO Group to be in, you know, having their malware being used, you know, for and tied. I mean, we've seen a bunch of ties previously to it, but this is pretty explicit. And it's just, you know, given the, you know, the rest of the ongoing kind of pressure on them, it's certainly not going to help.
No. And we got a really interesting one here from Joe Cox over at Vice. We've, of course, spoken a few times about the EncroChat hack, where it was the French cops, wasn't it, who owned EncroChat, which is like, you know, buy this phone and use it for crime and the cops will never see your messages. And turns out that was not accurate because the cops got everything. But that is actually what's going to wind up in the courts in the UK, because a lot of the people who are up on charges resulting from this breach are saying, well, hang on, can you actually take you know, these messages that were obtained by a non-UK law enforcement body, can you actually use them as evidence in a UK court? We say no. So it's going to get challenged. And I think that's, I mean, you know, I think that's good that this stuff is challenged, because otherwise you got cops just turning up with data that they got off the back of a truck every 10 minutes and using it in court. I don't know that that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I don't think we're surprised that this is one of the lines of defense that, you know, people were going to use. And yeah, it does make sense to go challenge it. You know, we do want lawful intercept and lawful, you know, technical investigation techniques, you know, to be solidly backed by, you know, the right of the police to go and do that and the appropriate oversights. And then, of course, you know, chain of custody and technical controls and the ability for people who are brought in front of a court to be able to challenge the evidence against them in a way that's meaningful. And, you know, we've seen that with other technical collection systems over the years. That, you know, it's a thing that, you know, is a very legitimate part of the process. And so it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in the UK. I mean, you know, the fact that it was the French police doing it, you know, presumably with some, you know, appropriate oversight, you know, versus situations where we've seen data stolen and then used for, you know, to, you know, as evidence of crimes in other places. So it's going to be an interesting one to see how it plays out.
But were the defendants named in those warrants, right? Probably not. You know, they probably ID'd them from the breach. So it all gets a little bit fraught. And what I just said before, you know, I mean, they didn't steal this data, but it definitely fell off the back of a truck.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's an interesting one. Like, it is complicated and, you know, it's not, you know, we wouldn't want to say, well, this is a bad idea and the police should never use technical means, because clearly they rounded up a lot of pretty bad dudes. And we saw some examples of the sorts of, you know, torture and murder and stuff that were being planned across this network. But on the other hand, right, I mean, we don't want free for all, you know, everyone gets hacked all the time by law enforcement. There's nothing we can do about it. Or worse, they just make it up and claim they got it. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Ransomware beat now, and Hackney Council in the United Kingdom has been smashed with ransomware. They've been down for a while now, and they're not coming back up anytime soon, according to the latest reporting. But this has prevented the council from paying housing benefits. So, I mean, there's every chance that people could start getting evicted during a pandemic because of this ransomware attack.
Yeah,
release the hounds!
Exactly. This is the sort of thing that's just not really tolerable. And I, you know, I'm sure the UK has some hounds as well that, you know, they've had chained up for a while and would like to be released. So yeah, it seems like a reasonable time to do that to me.
Yes, I agree. Surprisingly enough, Fin11. Tell us about Fin11.
So Mandiant has identified another financial crime group, this time dubbed Fin11, after last, I think Fin10 was a couple of years ago now. And that's a group that's been seen targeting, you know, financial, retail, restaurant sectors, but also pretty unrestrained in targeting the medical and pharmaceutical worlds, which obviously is pretty topical right now. There hasn't been any attribution as to exactly where they're from, although Mandiant does say probably from one of the Russian-speaking countries, which, you know, I guess is the style.
Up and comers, one to keep an eye on. Good to know. Krebs on Security has a great story here about how 8kun, which is the reborn 8chan website, lost its DDoS protection. It lost its DDoS protection, which was being provided by a company in America. Now their DDoS protection is from Russia.
Well, I mean, I guess they have to go somewhere where they're welcome, and clearly that's where they are. This is interesting, you know, because Krebs talks through the process by which one of the upstream providers, you know, eventually just got the boss of one of the upstream providers got phoned and said, hey, do you realize you're hosting 8chan? And he went, well, or transiting traffic for 8chan. And they went, actually, no, we'll turn that off. Thanks very much. So, you know, these
within minutes. It didn't take a couple of years and a whole bunch of mass shootings. Funny that.
Yeah. I mean, this is exactly how perhaps things ought to work. You know, people just take responsibility for their infrastructure and the things that are done across it rather than, you know, being dicks about it.
Did you hear that, Matthew? What else have we got here? The kick-ass torrents guy who was arrested back in 2016, Artem Volin. He was arrested in Poland. He's hoofed it. He's done a runner. Run, dude, run.
Yes, now he has apparently left Poland in breach of his bail conditions.
They let him out of prison because he had a sore back. That's my favourite part of this.
Oh, dear. But anyway, I guess he must have some, you know, Where's Crew millions or something stashed away, and hopefully he's on his way to Thailand or Cambodia or wherever else, you know, the operators of torrent networks end up subsequently getting rearrested. But hey, maybe he's found somewhere else to go. I don't know.
And when I said he got released because he had a sore back, he was released because his lawyers argued that he suffered from spine-related maladies. So there you go. But he's running. He's running.
Yeah, I guess he can run still, yes.
Man, now this is some real lateral thinking when it comes to running an anonymization network. I mean, Tor, eat your heart out. Adam, tell us about this one.
Ours is reporting on a botnet called Interplanetary Storm. It's a pretty cool name. Which is a botnet built out of largely compromised Android devices and then is being used to build a proxy network. So people are, you know, obviously we've seen botnets run proxies before, but this one is interesting because it really looks like it's been kind of purpose-built by someone who knows what they're doing to become a distributed proxy network.
But it's for profit. This is the funny part. It's actually a business. This is like pay to anonymize your traffic business, and you wind up getting routed through some dude's phone somewhere, you know? It's great.
But it's a very competitive market at the moment. You see all the, you know, advertising from all of the other VPN firms. So, you know, you got to compete somehow. And one of the ways is competing on price. You know, you can not have to pay for any of your hosting or servers or anything. Just use other people's boxes. I mean, we've seen people do it in the voice over IP world. You know, entire call centers running out of stolen VoIP access. So why not
for anonymizing VPNs? That's their edge. Exactly. It's
competitive.
Their competitive advantage, I think is the term.
Crime.
Zoom is rolling out end-to-end encrypted calls, thus quieting the complaints of people who stopped complaining months ago anyway.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how much this is such a non-story in a way, and yet it was such a big thing, you know, 3 months ago, everyone was talking about Zoom crypto, and now it's like, yeah, they just turned on end-to-end crypto, job done, next feature. That's a really cool kind of, you know, redemption story in a way. I mean, they've got a...
But I think it's also account. Like, I mean, the cynic in me is just like, even if they hadn't have done this, people would have forgotten about it. Like, it was just, Zoom was the latest thing popping up that everyone got to throw rocks at. And, you know, sure, there was room for improvement there, but it was just such a case of the pitchfork wielding mob at the time.
Yeah, and, you know, perfect storm with COVID and everyone working from home and everyone using Zoom for all sorts of things that they probably shouldn't have. But, yeah, now they've ended up with a better product that's more competitive and good on them, I guess.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not saying this is a bad result. I'm just being cynical because, you know.
I mean, you're right. No one would remember. Like, there's so much other rubbish going on at the moment.
You and I both did exactly the same thing upon reading this story. This is another one on ZDNet, but Catalin Kimpanu reports that Project Zero team lead Ben Hawks, a friend of yours and mine, observed a threat actor abusing a Chrome O'Day in the wild, and there's a patch available. And I think I got about three paragraphs into this story and just went, update, can finish reading the news later.
Exactly right. Yeah. Anytime there's Chrome bugs, you know, you do want to patch your Chrome. And when Ben Hawks says to patch your Chrome, you really want to patch your Chrome because that guy doesn't muck around. So yes, everybody patch your Chrome. This has apparently been used by someone in the wild, and font rendering bugs, like this is in the free type font rendering library. And there's been so many of those over the years, and it's kind of sad in the way that they're still there. But yeah, moral of the story, patch your Chrome.
Patchy Chromes. NSS Labs is no more. This is a company that had been around for decades, purporting to offer independent testing of security technologies. I mean, I think they were more relevant, 20 years ago than they have been in the last 10 years. But they'd always been a source of controversy, you know. Vendors had alleged that they were offering pay to play, whereas they always said that they were independent. There have been lawsuits flying around with it. I mean, you know, just certainly NSS Labs were a controversial organization, and now they're dead skis.
Yeah, I mean, I think they've been in a decline for a while. And certainly anytime you talk to anyone that worked at, firewall companies, AV companies, IDS companies, you know, where they were seen as a thing that you needed to do to kind of play in the marketplace, no one had much nice to say. So I'm not really surprised that they haven't been seeing a lot of business lately. And it's kind of sad in a way because, you know, so many security products, as is evidenced by the news list this week, are garbage. And having some way for customers and people who are going to buy them to tell that they're garbage is useful. But yeah, NSS Labs had not really been doing a good job of that for a long time. So I don't know that anyone's surprised.
I remember 10 years plus ago, a friend of mine at a vendor, like NSS Labs had pitched them, said, give us some money so that we can configure your thing for the test. And they didn't. And then they basically misconfigured this vendor's product and then tested it in a crap configuration. Do you know what I mean? So of course the test results were horrible. Like they were just renowned for doing stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. Like testing it with the AV turned off or whatever. Yeah, and saying it detected nothing, yes.
And then calling it rubbish. Like yeah, it just... Yeah.
No, I don't think anything of value was lost here today, other than, presumably some people lost their jobs. But, yeah, good riddance probably.
Now, I just want to highlight a publication this week before we go. Adam, the DFIR report, which I'd never heard of. Brett turned it up and then he kicked it around in Slack. And others there who are better positioned to comment on the quality of such things said that, yes, it is indeed a good resource.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you see, technical write-ups where you don't really know who's behind it because you always have to kind of judge a little bit, just based on the content without knowing what else is going on. But, I mean, I had a quick skim through some of the posts on this blog and there's some people do seem to know what they're talking about in this.
Yeah, I've linked through to one of their most recent posts about Ryuk, which is, Ryuk in 5 hours, which makes for sobering reading.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good write-up of exactly the process that a ransomware crew goes through, inside someone's environment and the tooling and the steps they're going through all looks 100% legit to me. The speed is certainly a thing that people should be looking at. I mean, it's a great, if you're trying to convince some of your executives, why you might need a bit more cash, a bit more focus, on internal controls and things, then being able to detect and respond to something like this in the window of 5 hours, like that takes quite a lot of work. And this is, good argument why you do need to be able to do that.
All righty. Well, mate, that is actually it for the week's news. Thanks a lot for joining us. And we'll do it all again next week. I think we're not going to do a show election week in the United States, which I know some listeners are going to say that's inviting disaster. But it's just our feeling that, you're all going to have you're all going to be focusing your attention elsewhere that week. So we may as well have a breather. But yeah, we'll pick it up again next week, Adam.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. Talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week security news. And yes, I know I mention it every week and I know I just mentioned it in the news discussion, but you really should subscribe to the Risky Business newsletter. We just don't have time to cover everything in the show and not everything lends itself well to discussion in a podcast. So there's a lot of other stuff in the newsletter that we didn't talk about here. So get on it, hit risky.biz/subscribe for the Substack link. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Jake King and Mike Sample from CMD Security. They make control and visibility software for Linux, but today they actually wanted to start off by talking about someone else's product. HashiCorp has released Boundary, a cloud-neutral remote access proxy thingy. Jake and Mike say technologies like these are great, but with more and more remote access being provisioned in 2020 because of, the thing, it's time to get serious about setting up meaningful controls on your production systems. Mike Sample starts off here by explaining what Boundary actually is.
Boundary is basically a cloud-neutral version of SSM and Google IAP. It allows your clients to tunnel TCP connections into your intranet or cloud VPC and access the servers, by SSH or whatever they need to get access to.
Now, we've already got a whole bunch of remote access, tools and techniques for these sorts of environments. Why is someone releasing something new? What's the problem that this one seeks to solve?
Well, I think with lots of HashiCorp technology, you see that they are cloud neutral and very well designed. And this one, unlike Google IAP or SSM, they're not tied to a cloud provider's IAM system or the services that only the cloud provider has. So you can learn this technology, apply it to your own data centers or, your cloud VPCs as well. And it works just as well.
Okay, so where is the IAM piece in of all of this? Do you plumb it through to like your SSO provider, like Okta or something, or like how does that work?
That's their plan. It's on the roadmap right now. They just support password authentication, but they are very open about bring your own identity provider to authenticate to this thing. But the part it provides on the backside of that is basically a directory of your users, groups, the roles and permissions, and the server groups they can access.
Now, I'm guessing we're talking about this because you're anticipating that this is going to become a popular technology.
Absolutely. We're seeing this with, people are setting up SSH bastions as kind of the technical person's, VPN access to services. They'll set up remote port forwarding and such like this to gain access to these things. Boundary makes it a lot more friendly to your average remote worker because it can automatically launch your SSH client or, PuTTY or curl or whatever you want without you having to, point these tools at some port on localhost and all that complex stuff that many people would probably curse at IT about.
So Jake King also joins us on this call. So why is CMD, which is essentially a Linux endpoint visibility play, like why are you talking about this HashiCorp thing?
Yeah, entry points, Pat. I think one of the things that we've really noticed over the last couple of months, and I think even more so as we've settled into this new remote normal, we're seeing dozens of different technology vendors come out with solutions that get you into production, get you into a network, and do a pretty good job of handling not only the access authentication, but authorization as well. And I think where this gets really interesting for us at CMD is we started to notice there was a lot of inconsistencies around observing actions that were being performed over these new transport tags. And I think where this gets really exciting is, for a lot of the CISOs, the CIOs out there, we've really added all of these new holes into the firewall for production. And we might not be actually monitoring them as well as we once thought. CMD is really uniquely positioned to help out in a couple of different ways here. And, Boundary is just a continuation of where a lot of this technology is going. We're seeing a lot of vendors bring in entry points that are non-standard. They're, managed. They could be managed by your operations team. And before you know it, this is the primary way that people are getting into production. Thankfully, we've got some capabilities to detect new entry points, kind of things that people are using to access production. And so being a transport layer agnostic solution, focusing on capturing this data at the endpoint has been pretty awesome for us to just see how some of these technologies are being used and how it's changed behaviors of engineering teams that are leveraging alternative ways to get into prod and given the new normal.
So this is interesting, right? Because there is another company that I can think of that has sponsored a couple of Risky Business episodes in the past. I won't name them because this is your time. This is your time, Jake. But, there's a couple of competing approaches here, which is like, so what you're saying is, okay, there's all these new alternative methods for accessing production environments. So you want to be on the endpoint. We do endpoint. We're going to spit out logs no matter how you got here. That makes a lot of sense. But there are competing plays that say, we are an identity and application and protocol aware proxy and, get all of your production maintainers to connect to your production environment through us and we'll do the logging here. So there seems to be two different approaches here, which is to do the logging at the proxy versus having, endpoint logging and control, which is what you offer. Mike, why don't you sell me on the endpoint approach versus the heavily logged proxy approach? Go.
Sure. End-to-end encryption. I want to use the tools I like SSH from OpenSSH. I have a ton of scripts that use that automatically. I don't want to be forced to retool those to use some other way to get in there. End-to-end encryption is a key one. And also observing terminal output is really a terrible way to see what's going on a Linux box. And it can be defeated so easily.
What about you, Jake? Like, give us your best pitch for the endpoint control of it. And then I'll give you my pitch, right? Because I've got one. But, yeah. give us your best pitch for why endpoint versus proxy is the way to go.
I think it came from, really where we started CMD from, which was being able to kind of capture obscured or obfuscated methods of trying to exfil data or trying to obfuscate an action over the wire. There's been a lot of ways we can get around TTY recording or just connection recording. And from an OS perspective or on a deployed agent perspective, we get the full footprint of what's going on within that workload. We can see the runtime. We can see applications that are forked, files that are changed, actions that have maybe not echoed something back to the terminal, but have performed something a little bit malicious or a little bit unusual. And we can do it in such a way where you can query and obviously search for a lot of this information and compare it to other data sets that you might have. So in contrast to using a proxy-based solution to capture a lot of the data as it goes over the wire to the client, you know, we've got the ability to look at the exact binary that was executed, the forks that it made, any files that were written by that binary, even different connections that are made from that binary. And I think where this gets really interesting for a number of the folks out there is now you're no longer trying to reconstruct from a single side of the conversation, but you're actually able to see exactly what's going on the endpoint, what's actually occurred and what's actually changed.
Well, and I guess, you know, you've got that added control, right? Because, you know, CMD, it's an endpoint control as well as a visibility tool, which gives you a further benefit. Like I'm gonna guess that it's probably harder to roll out CMD across every single Linux device than it is to just whack a proxy in front of them, but it gets you further. I mean, that's, if we're gonna be honest, that's the way it is, right?
Yeah, we do hear this one a little bit, and I think it's an interesting point to bring up. If you've got a well-orchestrated system environment, which, look, we all want to have that beautiful orchestration in Terraform, but we're just not there yet. Yeah, it's a bit of a tricky one. You know, I'm of the opinion that if your engineers are accessing a workload and that workload isn't managed, or at least isn't managed well enough to deploy a, you know, pretty lightweight binary, you've probably got bigger problems on your plate in many of these cases. I think what I will say, though, is, yeah, it is a little bit more difficult, but it's a longer term solution that gets you a lot further in the long run.
And Mike, this HashiCorp stuff, it's not the, surely it's not the only, you know, new way that companies are provisioning access to their production environments in this, the age of COVID and remote working. What else have you seen over the year?
We've seen people moving to VPNs like Tailscale, which uses WireGuard. We've also seen more use of IAP and SSM as people are realizing they actually have proxy functionality built into them.
It's been the year of the identity-aware proxies, right?
I would agree 100% with that. We're all working at home right now.
I think the world is definitely going in that direction, and getting a bit of a handle of what's going on in there is probably important too.
Now, Jake, while I've got you here, I just wanted to ask you about this Linux malware that Cyber Command reported on back in August. Like, no one has been able to turn up a sample. You were asking your contacts, like, does anyone know? And I reached out to a few people on your behalf to see if I could track one down for you, and I came up empty-handed. So I'm told this thing was in the wild but in very limited circulation, and, yeah, no one seems to have samples. But that, I mean, you must have been paying very close attention to, you know, Linux malware being the number one sort of agenda item in a week in August for InfoSec. That's music to your ears, I would imagine. What are your feelings on that whole episode?
Absolutely. It's been really interesting. First and foremost, it's interesting to see that we're seeing targeted attacks against infrastructure and not necessarily just Linux endpoints that people may be using for, you know, personal use or obfuscation or, you know, kind of just to run that live CD to run tails and kind of get away with what they want to get away with. It's been really interesting to see a lot of the target shift to infrastructure. What I will say is I was very surprised by the sheer amount of press that the topic kind of got. And I think what I was most interested by is just the lack of samples that were out there. It does prove that these kind of malware targets are, you know, generally very kind of, you know, used with scalpel level precision. And it does bring up the question often, you know, in the back of my mind, how often are we seeing these kind of things and maybe just overlooking them?
Well, okay. So that's the interesting thing that came out of this for me, right? Which is like, no one had seen it, but like, who's looking? Right? Like observability, like no one is doing appropriate monitoring of their Linux environments. Right. So I figured, you know, you would be all over this, and your client like might not have even seen this thing once it was on the box. But it would be, you know, a box running CMD would be less likely to get that malware on it in the first place, but it was pretty, from the write-ups, it looks like it was pretty good stuff, you know?
Yeah, I think the level of sophistication from, you know, obviously the campaign was pretty clear and present in a lot of the ways that you could detect the malware. It was connectivity to a certain amount of endpoints or connectivity inbound to your network on a certain amount of endpoints. We actually have a great blog write-up by one of our security engineers, Derek, and the CMD team, who kind of analyzed a lot of what was going on in the media and at least distilled it down a little bit more in some different ways. But I think that the one challenge that we've identified is, look, you know, the kernel might be lying to you. Lots of different endpoints might be lying to you on Linux systems. and seeing the level of sophistication in a lot of the you know the Windows variants of malware varieties that we're seeing in the industry today, you know, I can only imagine the complexity that we're going to be seeing in Linux and we're going to be discovering in Linux is going to be really interesting. Where I would suggest, you know, a lot of the listeners kind of, you know, take a look at is, you know, would you have the ability to discover, you know, payloads, you know, kind of just, you know, even hypothetically to the level of sophistication of some of the malware variants, even for Windows out there. Just because a lot of the time we're making assumptions that we're collecting enough information to reconstruct a particular, you know, attack or look at the way a binary made a change to a system. And it's just often you're left holding the bag with not too many logs and maybe a little bit of audit trail that's locally stored. I'd hazard a guess that in the next, you know, months and years, we're going to see some very sophisticated adversaries popping up within Linux and Unix land. And you're exactly right. Looking at ways to appropriately detect these kind of attacks is going to be insanely fun to
because, I mean, you, with you guys, you might catch them during the actual installation of the malware and then maybe during lateral movement. But even then, I mean, this was a pretty tricky one, right?
Yeah, with some of our eBPF technology, I think we have a pretty amazing vantage point on the host to capture a lot of background process information that's running on the system. So if there's an active process writing to a file, you know, executing and forking, doing different things, you know, we've got a pretty incredible data model that's going to represent really any background task operating on the system, as long you know, as well as the instrumentation from an entry point or a lateral movement. But it's really when the adversary acts on objectives that you're probably going to be likely to see them. You know, kind of crop their head up.
That's it. That was exactly what I was thinking. Eventually, they're going to stick their head up, right? And that's when you'll see them.
Yeah. I think it's going to be interesting to see how traditional kind of, you know, Unix and Linux, you know, system controls, native controls are going to be leveraged.
But I think what you're doing is subtly agreeing with me that once that particular bit of malware is on a particular host, that host is done.
it's kind of done.
Yeah.
I mean, reconstruction is always going to be fun. You know, I think forensic analysis here is going to be a lot of fun, but can you trust the system?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe, that's a fun one.
So, re-spin and redeploy.
It sounds like you were impressed with that work by our friends in Russia.
Relatively impressed. Can't wait to get a sample.
Yeah, did you hear that, folks? Hook Jake up. He wants a sample. Mike, you have some feelings on, and that's the name of the malware, isn't it? Dvorub. You've got some feelings there.
I do. I think people should be looking at LSMs more, in that you've got BPF LSM coming along, and you've got two LSM points that would have shut down this module loading. You've got init module and finit module, I believe, which would have blocked it in its tracks.
All right, Jake King, Mike Sample, thank you so much for joining us on the show to talk about a whole bunch of topics there. It's been a real pleasure to chat to you both.
Thanks, Pat.
That was Jake King and Mike Sample from CMD Security there, and you can check them out at cmd.com. And we're going to do something we haven't done in a while today and play a feature track this week. Kinda. As a lot of you know, Australia has done very well with COVID, but we did have a second wave in the state of Victoria that has seen people basically locked in their homes for months on end. And the good news is, finally, case numbers down there are under control. Victoria is logging like between 1 and 3 cases a day, and the hope is contact tracers and isolation orders will be able to keep the virus at bay. The Victorian Premier, Dan Andrews, has been doing daily press conferences, and yeah, someone's remixed them. This absolute banger popped up on Twitter, and it goes out to all of you in Victoria who took the hit, not just for each other, but for all of us, for the whole country. We owe you for that one. You didn't go out on the beers, you stayed at home and got on the beers, you legends. So here's the Dan Andrews Get on the Beers remix featuring guest appearances from Scott Morrison and Donald Trump. I do hope you enjoy it. I'll be back in a day or two with a Snake Oilers edition. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
I'll just make this point. On Easter, we've got a long weekend coming up. We do not have a holiday weekend coming up. No one. No one likes beers more than I do, right? No one. This Easter weekend, stay on the beers at home.
That's the key point. So stay at home, get on the beers. That's your civic duty. That's what's most important. And that's what must be done. Beers, beers, beers. Get on the beers, 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 beers. Get on the beers, 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 beers.
No,
beers, beers, beers.
China,
beers, beers, beers. Get on the beers. Take this seriously. Get on the beers. Rapidly. Get on the beers. That's your civic duty. Beers. Get on the beers. That's what's most important. Beers. That's what's most important. Beers. That's what's most important. Beers. And that's what must be done. Beers.
I can honestly say I never had a beer in my life, okay?